Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. In the studio this week is also Russell Chianelli. But we're going to be talking predominantly with an interesting gentleman, John Ridley. He's a professor of geology from Colorado State University. He's had careers in many, many parts of the world, the Greek Islands, Australia, Zimbabwe, now, of course, the United States. And we're going to be talking about many, many different aspects, and we'll come to them in due course. But first of all, John, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Thank you, Keith. Yeah.
Before we get on to all these interesting things that we're going to cover, how did you become a scientist? What were those driving forces for you as a kid?
Well, unfortunately, it was really quite simple. I didn't have much choice in it. Both of my parents were scientists. And even one of my grandparents was a geologist, even though, unfortunately, I never met him. He was a geologist in the oil fields in Peru. If you have parents who are scientists and you're good at it at school, it would be pretty difficult to avoid being a scientist. So
all of my children have avoided it except one. So 80% of my children have avoided it. I must not be a good scientist model.
Maybe not, or maybe when I was growing up, there was enough of confidence that science was something that was worth studying, worth pursuing. That there was no reason to question your calling in that.
That's
respect.
Interesting. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Scotland and England, partly just outside Edinburgh, partly in Oxfordshire. Yeah, a mixture of the UK.
Okay. Why geology?
Why geology? It was, in a way, chance. I went to university. I went to college to study physics. Again, I think because that's what I was good at. And in the first year, I had to take multiple sciences, of which one was geology. And I was pushed away from physics, and I was pulled towards geology in part because I found I can do this. I can understand the landscape. We went on a field trip for a week up on the Isle of Arran, which is a famous geological locality up in Scotland, and I could understand what I was looking at. So I decided to swap major, and from there I became a geologist.
So what you're saying is that physics was tougher for you and geology was so much easier?
I think they deliberately made physics tough.
This is in Cambridge.
This is in Cambridge.
So they've got a sort of a history of good physics.
Yeah. they've got a history, and I think also universities can be like that. They can deliberately try and choose the students even if they're not allowed to.
Okay. So you went to graduate school in?
In Edinburgh.
Okay.
And my project was based around mapping a Greek island. The whole of an island. I spent about 9 months actually on the island. Going around.
Which island was it, by the way?
This was the island of Syros.
Yeah.
Syros, sorry. So I went around from village to village, stayed in rooms and walked over the hills, and the locals thought I was crazy and took lots of samples. And then when I was...
You know what? Yeah. Because I have part of my family, my daughter is married a Greek, and they go to Greece all the time, and I'm always interested in that. When you're walking around an island like that doing geology, don't you run into things that are buried, historical?
Geology is, how should we say, much older than archaeology. Yes, I could have run into things, but I suppose I was a good student and kept my mind on what I was supposed to
no,
be doing.
No, but I mean when you just accidentally.
Yes, I have subsequently found things I probably shouldn't have done. When I was there, I knew where the ancient sites were. The island is actually slightly unusual because there are almost no ancient sites from the ancient Greek civilizations.
So it's pretty inhospitable.
It's pretty dry. It's a barren, bare landscape.
So what was the interest? I mean, this was back, 30 years ago or something.
Yeah.
What was the rationale for discovering your own little island that nobody had looked at and you were going to map it? What were you going to gain from that particular study, apart from idyllic survival, perhaps?
Yeah. So this was relatively soon after the acceptance of plate tectonics as a paradigm as to how the world worked on a large scale. Plate tectonics, in many respects, is a simplification. It looks at the whole globe. It says the globe consists of plates which are moving relative to each other, and where two plates come together, they're either coming together, the plates are either coming together, they're moving apart to produce new ocean
and
crust.
And why the continents have the shape that they do.
And why the continents have the shapes that they do, and so on. But actually linking that overall theory with what we saw when we go and map at a much smaller scale was, and probably still is, not perfectly understood. So so my advisor sent me to this island because it was considered a possible environment where we were looking at rocks which had been subducted, in other words, pushed down underneath the top of one continent, pushed down underneath another continent. And the reason we knew this was because the metamorphism, the pressures and temperatures which these rocks had been subjected to were such that they had a relatively high pressure to temperature ratio. Rocks are very poor conductors, so when you take a rock from the surface of the earth and push it down underneath other rocks, even though the temperature is higher at depth, because you've started at 0 degrees centigrade, the temperature is going to lag behind what is normally expected. So you end up with a relatively high pressure to temperature.
So what did you discover? What did you discover? Smoking gun?
No, I actually didn't. Even though since I worked there 30 years ago, it's now a favorite place for geologists from all over Europe to do their studies. And I think most of the papers will say that this is a fossil subduction zone. But I could actually not see any really clear evidence for that. Geology is more complex. And it's essentially, yes, we know that it's related to convergence of two plates. With convergence of two plates, you can get a complex zone in which the crust as a whole has thickened. But that's not necessarily the same as saying it's been pushed down a subduction zone.
So all these subsequent researchers, they're always quoting your paper, right? I mean, your papers, right? I mean, you've got a sort of a notoriety.
I have got a notoriety, but that's got a shelf life.
Oh, don't we all?
Yeah, And I think now there's been enough work that my work's been largely forgotten about. Not largely forgotten about, but okay. We all move on. So
let's just go on to plate tectonics just for one quick feature. I was watching a tennis match yesterday where this Briton from Scotland, actually, Murray, became the number one tennis player, beat Djokovic in two sets. But they kept on advertising that this tennis tournament has been all over the world on six continents. And I grew up thinking of five continents. And now I think North America and South America are supposedly two separate ones. But then I was reading that some people, geologists in particular, resist the temptation of saying Europe and Asia are two separate continents. So bring us up to date on continents and tectonics. Where are we? How many continents should we really be thinking about?
It depends on the question you're actually asking. I mean, I would, as a general rule, Eurasia is the term which we will use for Europe and Asia combined, because there is no clear geological boundary between the two. You can put the boundary along the Ural Mountains, those are old mountains, and essentially that's been inactive for 250 million years, something like that. Just, I can't remember the exact number.
Why would you?
and what's more important in respect to geology is the life forms that obviously different continents or different life forms develop on different continents, largely because they're isolated or semi-isolated, and the concept amongst the biological sciences is of the Palearctic. The old Arctic continents, which is one assembly, there's a better word which is escaped me at present, but a more precise word for this. But essentially, there's no difference in the birds that live in northern Europe and the birds who live in northern Siberia. However, there are significant or minor differences. However, you know, you move to Zimbabwe and you're dealing with completely different life forms. So there is a biological boundary between Europe and Africa, but there is not a clear biological boundary between.
Oh, there's lots of questions about that. Yeah. And one of the things that interested me in the continental drift and all that is that I was reading a story where the ancient Egyptians had a ceremony in the pyramid where they were looking at the sun and or some stars and so on. And when that was repeated, it had moved. And they figured out that Africa had moved so many degrees because that thing was now misaligned.
I have a feeling there's a misunderstanding here because the rate of plate tectonic movement is measured in centimeters per year if you're lucky. So over the period of the Egyptian civilizations, you're only talking about moving a few meters.
Yeah, but that was one of the papers about how they know that continental drift occurred.
So did they also check whether there was any subsidence in the pyramids and things like that?
Well, I think it's a different discussion, but that's I remember.
Well, it's an interesting idea, anyway.
Yeah.
Tell us, you just mentioned Zimbabwe, and you told me earlier before we came on air that you spent a time in Zimbabwe as a faculty, your first faculty position. Yeah. Yeah. Tell us about that experience and what was interesting geologically and then socially in Zimbabwe.
I mean, many things. Obviously, geologically, Zimbabwe is a high plateau, largely, and that high plateau is there because it's a coherent geological unit. It's what we call a craton, ancient rocks, which has essentially been totally undisturbed by any mountain building, anything for 2,500 million years. And the Earth worked differently in those days. The whole Earth, the center, the interior of the Earth was probably hotter. It's disputed as to how much and so on. The what we call the geothermal gradient was probably steeper. The temperature at any depth was higher. What I would argue you can see in Zimbabwe and other terrains which are as old is the evidence of the fact that the crust was more kind of gooey, for want of a better word. It's also the time, just before 2,500 million years ago, is the time in the Earth's history when a very large proportion of the world's gold reserves, gold deposits, were formed. The most famous is probably the Witwatersrand in South Africa, from which still even now over 30% of the world's gold has come from this one area of deposits.
I forget the name, but there's a movie about that.
There's a movie about that? I can't remember that.
Yeah.
So in Zimbabwe, I not only because of the geology, but also because as a geologist, you were very much somebody who was contributing to the wealth of the country, to the wealth of a poor country by not only finding ore deposits, evaluating them, but also, more importantly, as a professor, training the people who would go out and be the next
generation. Most of the students were African or
European? 99% of our students were African. Yeah, it was very rare to have a white student. I mean, there was 250,000 whites in the country in those days. There were 8 million blacks. So, So most of the students were black. It was a very respectable profession to become a geologist and work in a mine. So we had very good students coming into geology. And I would say, hopefully not criticizing anyone subsequently, that probably overall they were my best students I ever had, the most committed, the most interested, the most able.
That's interesting and very nice to hear.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli this week, and we're talking to Professor John Ridley, Colorado State University up in Fort Collins, a home of some interesting breweries, and we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, John Ridley, Russell Chianelli. We're talking about different aspects of geology. And tell us, because Russell is here, I want to get to a slightly different topic. We were talking earlier, we had breakfast together, we were talking about these inclusions that one can find in all sorts of rocks, where there's these little trapped segments of water, mm-hmm. and within the water you can find all sorts of interesting things, mm-hmm. relating back to climate, for example, oxygen 16-17 ratios. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that it's becoming more common to find oil deposits or oil samples. Tell us a little about that sort of discovery and what's its implication.
All right. What the discovery was, the fact that we get these little trapped inclusions of oils and minerals has been known for a long time, and the oil industry uses it to trace migration pathways of oil through the rock. Oil forms in one rock, it then migrates and gets trapped somewhere else, and that's what is exploited. What we discovered when I was working in Sydney was that there was also oil in some very old rocks which were formed before life became multicellular. So the origin of life is obviously something that is very interesting, very difficult to get a hold of, in part because over the majority of life's history, life was only unicellular. Most of it was not preserved, could not be preserved as fossils. We're looking for isotope records. We're looking for, in this case, we were looking for oil, which obviously is the result of degradation of biological molecules in rocks over time. So what we discovered is that even as old as actually the same rocks which hold the gold deposits in the Vatrasrand, so they are about 2,900 million years old, something like that. We had some of these small inclusions, typically about 10 microns diameter. Which had oil in them. We found samples from various parts of the world which have this. So not only studied them from looking at them, what could you actually tell with a microscope? There's an extra complexity here, is that oil will not survive if you heat it up above about 250 degrees centigrade. So if you're
it's interesting because you can tell something about the origin of the oil from the molecules that are in it.
That's exactly what we did. So we crushed up the samples. This was at CSIRO, the government laboratories in Sydney. We crushed up the samples under organic solvent, extracted the oil that was in the inclusions, and then did a molecular analysis, GCMS. So molecular analysis of these oils, as was correctly said, can tell you something about the organisms that were actually there and gave rise to these
oils.
Was this
a heavy oil or a light oil that you worked with? Because in the heavy oils, there's something called hopanes, which you can really tell lots about the origins of the oil.
Yeah, that is essentially so the oils were not that heavy. However, there were sufficient hopanes and very importantly, sufficient steranes.
I think we've got to take a little issue here. Explain those two terms.
Russell can do it. He's probably more expert.
This is your moment to shine. Erudition online.
Well,
on
this
air.
Is
erudition on air.
Yeah. The hopanes and steranes that we're talking about here are remnants of the original organic material that formed the oil. And that's been important in oil spills because you can tell where the oil came from. Each oil has a unique fingerprint. And basically, that would be an entire show.
And that's because of those two components.
Yeah.
Not because of isotope ratios in propane,
methane.
No, this
is because of, that oil is made from the natural things that die and get crushed under the rocks, and that's a whole different show.
But okay. So, John, then.
All right. So
big molecules, by the way.
They're big molecules, and they've got a one end which consists of multiple cyclic carbon parts and then a chain at the other end, a simplistic way of saying it. But hopanes have five cycles, steranes have four. And the difference, and they are related back to the organisms on a very large, a very coarse scale. Steranes come from eukaryotes. So they are the organisms where the cells have a nucleus, whereas hopanes come largely from bacteria, which are the more primitive organisms, which don't have, where the cells do not have a nucleus. So there was a major step in the evolution of life, which was the development of the first organisms, which had which were eukaryotic. They were still unicellular, but that step was a major step in the development of life.
A related question: have you ever worked with the deep sea vents, where the core is coming out into the squirting into the water? And I was working on that because the Origins of Life people were saying that the molecules for life were formed on the iron sulfide that was being formed.
I have worked on those, but I haven't worked in this capacity on those deep sea vents, and that is a potential theory as to how life formed.
Yeah.
It explains such things as why life is cellular,
yeah.
Because when you bubble hot water out into cold seawater, it automatically forms bubbles approximately the size of ours or any other organism's cells, and it will have a membrane, and it will have organic molecules in the middle.
Going back to your results, though, and this analysis of the inclusion oils, did you come up with a sort of a period of time when there was this transformation
to
eukaryotic cells?
That was the important thing we did, that we showed that eukaryotic cells had developed much earlier in the Earth's history than had previously been clearly demonstrated. So we pushed the time back to about 2,400 million years ago. Whereas
you pushed it back 2,400?
2,400. So it had been around, the confirmed eukaryotic cells had been identified from about 1,700 million years, and we pushed it back to 2,400, which, interestingly, it was almost exactly the same time as the Great Oxidation Event.
Ah, now
which
that,
is
well,
which I
we
think
to,
is where
have,
you want
to. We have to pause again because we come up with another term. I'm learning a lot today. I usually back
you
that off. I was
going
to say I usually don't,
else.
But yeah. So, well, yes, because I'm learning a lot today. But I've never heard the expression, the Great Oxidation Event.
Yeah.
Please.
All right.
The floor is yours, John.
All right. Nothing is certain about the early Earth. I mean, we weren't there. There was nobody taking records. We have to interpret rocks, and the record that's in rocks is imperfect. It's generally accepted that the atmosphere that first formed on the Earth did not have molecular oxygen in it. Nowadays, we have approximately 20% molecular oxygen. Exactly what the atmosphere was made up of is uncertain, but probably a mixture of methane, maybe in small amounts, carbon dioxide, nitrogen. Where does the oxygen come from? Why do we have oxygen? At present day, and this is the easiest explanation as to why oxygen is in the atmosphere, it's produced by oxygenic photosynthesis. So the Earth's atmosphere started off without molecular oxygen, and then through life producing oxygen, photosynthetic life producing oxygen, we then produced oxygen, and that built up in the atmosphere. So when did that happen? We can tie that down fairly precisely to about 2,400 million years ago, approximately. The number,
so just around the same time when you were finding
exactly
the genesis of the oil.
The genesis of the eukaryotic organisms. Right. The two appear to be somehow related. That is also a time where people believe that because of changes in the balance of insulation and so on, there was a almost global glaciation. Snowball Earth. Have you ever heard that term before? It's generally considered because of a
what
combination.
About the, I was reading about this recently. The wiping out of the dinosaurs when the meteorite hit. Is that really something that could change, you know, a big thing colliding with the Earth?
That's a very transient, that the effect would be transient from a geological time frame, but you have to realize that geologists, anything less than 10,000 years is pretty small. Yeah.
When was that?
That was recently. That was recently. Yeah. That was the end of the Cretaceous.
I mean, what he's talking about is 2.9 thousand million years ago.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. Look, we're coming to the end of the program.
Be great what to have another show. There's so much to talk about.
Well, there is. There always is. But tell us what right now is exciting you.
What is exciting me now? Well, I'm actually giving a talk this afternoon at UTEP, which is about the ore deposits in Western U.S. All of the mineral deposits. I'm trying to compile the data and put together some idea as to why we get such a variety, why this was such a rich part of the world in terms of metal deposits. I mean, obviously, that's important for the wealth of the U.S., or was important for the wealth of the U.S.
I was going to say, I mean, are there too many? Is mineralogy, not mineralogy, what's the word? The excavation or the mining, I guess, of minerals these days. Is that a big industry still in
It's not a big industry, but that was a major reason why people came here, settled here.
Oh, that's why they have opera houses in Leadville and places like that.
Exactly, and there was an enormous wealth came into the country from exploiting these mineral deposits.
I should mention that you have a book called Ore Deposit Geology.
Okay. Yeah.
The people listening out there should know that if they want to learn more about this, there it is.
There it is. But that book is written for students at about the senior level, students who already know a little about who've had more than one
and geology students to boot, right?
Yeah.
No, not just
yes,
your average.
Yes, one of my brothers said this is very boring because he's not a geologist. So.
When you look back on the career, you know, and you're in the prime of your career right now. You've got another 20 or so years to go, I assume. But what was the most exciting moment? That business of determining, you know, the age of your formation of eukaryotic cells. Mm-hmm. And was that, wow, that's interesting. Is that as excited as you've ever been? Or was there one other feature that got you more excited in your own career?
In my own career, that was an awful lot of very meticulous work to get to that last point with the eukaryotic cells. Obviously, scientists love those moments when inspiration just comes, especially if you're a geologist from sitting on the rocks and looking at them. And I think in many ways my most inspirational was when I was in Zimbabwe and first looking at the old rocks and just taking the students out. Rocks you have to understand by seeing them, by walking over them, by saying, oh, this one's different from that one, and so on. And just putting together models as to how the Earth might have been back more than halfway to its origin was perhaps the most interesting.
And working in a different environment.
Yes.
You know, with a different group of students that you had grown up with, I think, is also part of that issue.
Yes.
Thank you very much, John Ridley from Colorado State University, Department of Geosciences. Fascinating. I've learned a lot today. I've even taken notes and might be doing another program with you, because some of the other aspects we didn't get to is the role of teaching students some of this information and who we should be teaching and what should we be teaching. But maybe come back again.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
All right. Thank you.
And as always, yes, John, and thank you for the audience, because without them, well, the program would go on, I've got to tell you that, regardless of who listens. But we know there's an avid audience out there. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.